Now to introduce tonight's speaker. After receiving a bachelor's degree from Grinnell College, Professor Smith went on to receive a master's and doctoral degrees in classical languages from the University of North Carolina and the University of Toronto, respectively. Following a 10-year period as a member of the faculty of the University of Notre Dame, she has since been teaching at the University of Dallas, where she now holds the rank of associate professor in the philosophy department. She has spoken widely on college campuses, to clergy and to the laity, and has addressed the U.S. bishops 3 times at Pope John XXIII Medical Moral Research Workshops. She has published extensively. She has authored or edited 2 books on Humani Vitae and has published scholarly articles on Plato, virtue, abortion, and contraception in various academic journals. Professor Smith is currently in the midst of a grand tour of the dioceses in the state of Ohio and has kindly consented to fit us into her very tightly packed schedule. We in the Guild are most pleased to be able to sponsor this segment of her trip and would like to welcome her here to our city. Professor Smith, we hope that your brief stay with us is a pleasant one and that there will be, as a result of your visit, a new and energized interest and understanding of the Church's age-old teaching regarding family and marriage. So without further delay, I give you Dr. Janet Smith.
Thank you. It's really very nice to be here. I grew up in Pennsylvania, in Warren, Pennsylvania. It's not so far away. And my mother grew up in Cleveland and my father in Ashtabula. So it's always nice to be around familiar terrain. It's somehow consoling. Okay. Now, as the doctor mentioned, I've written quite a bit on this topic. In fact, I think one book is 480 pages and the other one is longer. So that means I have a lot to say. That's not always good news for an audience, especially when you're seated in such hard seats there. And I do have a problem. I'm a nonstop talker. But I want you to know I belong to a support group. It's sometimes difficult to get away from that support group. But it's called the On and On Anon Society. Right? And they tell us at the On and On Anon Society to make certain that we don't go on and on. And one way of doing that is to capture our thoughts in some short, pithy statement. And I borrowed this statement from Garrison Keillor. You may know him. He's the radio humorist who does Prairie Home Companion and talks about Lake Wobegon. He talks about Father Emil, who's the pastor at Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility Church. And he gives a homily once a year on contraception. It goes like this. It may take you a while to see what he's up to, but it's a one-sentence homily on the church's teaching on contraception. And it goes, if you don't want to go to Minneapolis, what are you doing on the train? Okay. Think about that for a while. You'll have a whole hour here to think about that and get the gist of it. All right, so my topic tonight really is contraception. The church is teaching on contraception, various sexual issues. There's a great connection here between the many sexual issues. And as you know, we live in a culture that thinks that contraception is one of the greatest inventions in the history of mankind. If you were to ask people if they wanted to give up their car or their computer or their contraceptive, it'd be a hard choice to make. It's really considered to be something that's really put us greatly into the modern age, and again, one of the greatest advances of modern medicine and modern times. And there's this archaic church that tells us that really this was one of the worst inventions of mankind. It's one of the things that's plunging us into a kind of a disaster. So you have this great polarization, a world that thinks it's one of the greatest things going, and this church that says it's one of the worst things going. And I'm going to try to help people see tonight why the church's teaching certainly deserves serious consideration. And what most people don't know is that every Christian church up until 1930 taught that contraception was wrong. So it's a universal teaching within Christian churches. And it was only in 1930 that the Anglican church first broke with that unbroken tradition and approved contraception within marriage for serious reasons. In 1931, Pope Pius XI wrote the encyclical Casti Connubii, which is usually translated on Christian marriage. And there he reiterated what had been the constant teaching of the church. And within the Catholic Church, there was virtually no debate on this issue until the mid-1960s. Really, you can date it to about 1963. And there was really a great acceptance of the church, those in the church, of the teaching of the church. In 1960, some 66% of Catholics were living by the church's teaching. 66%. And now they say some 80% of Catholics are contracepting. 30% of Catholics are sterilized, which is the same rate as the rest of the population. And they say some 4% of Catholics are using natural family planning. I personally think that might be a high estimate. So how have we in the last 30 years gone from 66% compliance to, at best, 4% compliance? Partly what I want to look at tonight. Well, there's a couple reasons I'll give you right away why in 1960 it seems that 66% were compliant. One is that there really weren't very good contraceptives at the time. The pill was not yet really on the market. It had just begun to be developed. Right? And most contraceptives were illegal in most states, at least for interstate purchase. And those laws that made contraception illegal were really put on the books by Protestant legislators. Right? Contraception was always seen to be the source of great sexual license in society and considered to be something that a morally upright side society would ban. But as you all know, because of the doctrine of the right to privacy found in the penumbra of the Constitution, those laws were thrown out in the early 1960s. And that was really the precursor to Roe versus Wade. That right to privacy is found in Griswold versus the state of Connecticut, and then is reiterated in Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion. It was also at the time that, for Catholics at least, obedience was considered to be a virtue. It was not yet seen to be a pathological condition. So Catholics were prepared to accept what their church taught simply because it taught it, in fact, whether or not they understood it. Now, in the 1960s, the pill became available, and that's really where the revolution in contraceptives began. Again, it was considered to be a great salvation of mankind for several reasons. There was the beginning of the belief that we were headed for a disaster as far as a population problem was concerned. In fact, when I was in high school, we had posters of globes with human beings falling off the globe. It was so crowded. But there actually have been no two people who have been more wrong than Malthus and Paul Ehrlich. You can look this up. You can read the literature on this. I recommend books by a man named Julian Simon and another man, Ben Wattenberg, who are demographers, and there's many others, Jacqueline Cazoon, who have looked at their work. Malthus said that the population would increase geometrically and the food supplies would only, at best, increase arithmetically. The population has increased enormously. But the good news, and that's not necessarily bad news, that's just a fact, it has increased enormously. The good news is that the food supply is wildly better off than Malthus ever dreamed. The United States could quite easily feed the rest of the globe. It's not a problem. Modern agricultural techniques have exponentially increased our food supply. And they say we haven't even begun to mine the ocean for food. And as far as for limited mineral resources and that sort of thing, Malthus thought we certainly would run out of coal and run out of copper and these sorts of things. But we actually have more coal and more copper now per person on the globe than Malthus thought we had at his time. We've discovered more resources, and we need them less because we have such things as atomic energy. So I'm not here to argue against the population scare. I'm just here to tell you that there's good reason to doubt it. And you might wonder why we see these emaciated children on TV starving and why this is something, gosh, we must be overpopulated. Look at all these starving children. It has little to do with population, really. It has a great deal to do with one tribal or ethnic group hating and starving out another tribal and ethnic group. It has a great deal to do with corrupt governments and the failure to distribute food. It has a great deal to do with natural disasters that we can have little control over. But that was one of the reasons that we thought the pill was going to be a great thing. It's going to help us with population problems. And the second thing was feminism. There was a rapid growth in interest in feminism, and certainly we had to have contraceptives because women couldn't get in the workplace and find their fulfillment unless they were having fewer babies, and the only way they could have fewer babies is with a better contraceptive. It was also believed that contraceptives, especially the pill, would make for much better marriages, because clearly people could now use contraceptives within marriage and get rid of the fear of pregnancy that was dampening the spontaneous and blissful sex lives that spouses hoped that they could have. Take the tension out of the sex life that was there because of a fear of pregnancy. And it didn't take people long to catch on. Well, gee, if you could wipe the fear of pregnancy out of sex within marriage, you could wipe the fear of pregnancy of sex before marriage. And surely it would make sense to have sex before marriage. I was a teenager in the 60s, and this became to be the wisdom of the times. Surely none of you would buy a car unless you took it for a test drive. It's just as idiotic, of course, to get married without having sex with your prospective spouse. And none of you would really buy a car without test driving several cars, right? That would also be idiotic. You want to find out what model you like, right? You want to see how it drives. It's the same thing then in the 60s. We were actually, this was wisdom at the time. It was the earlier generations, it was unfortunate. They more or less had to restrain themselves before marriage and sort of plunged into marriage because they were desperate for sex. And now we could be free from that kind of desperation by having sex outside of marriage, making a calmer, cooler, more collected assessment of our future spouse by being able to have a sexual relationship before marriage. This was considered to be great wisdom. And of course, we thought there would be an enormous decrease in the number of unwanted pregnancies. Surely contraception would help people not get pregnant when they didn't want to get pregnant. And concomitant with a decrease in unwanted pregnancies, there would surely be a decrease in the number of abortions. Now, these were the expectations for the contraceptive pill in the 60s. And I think none of these were stupid expectations. It seems to me on the surface there's a great deal of logic to this and a great deal of plausibility to these expectations. But the Catholic Church at the time said, no, that won't be the case. It was in 1968 that Pope Paul VI issued Humanae Vitae. Looks like some of you might have been alive and aware at that time. You might remember that it felt like a bomb, on the Church and the rest of society. It was a shock to everyone that the Catholic Church reiterated its constant teaching against contraception. And Pope Paul VI, in section 17 of Humanae Vitae, made several predictions about what would happen if contraceptives became widely available and widely used in society. He said, first of all, that there would be a general lowering of morality in society. Now, for those of you who are here in the 60s and a lot awake and aware, and are here in the 1990s, I don't know that I have to do a lot to convince you that there's been a general lowering of morality. I remember watching TV when I was a teenager in the 60s. We saw Donna Reed's show, I Love Lucy, Father Knows Best, you know, the Spin and Marty show, all sorts of great family entertainment. And now I can hardly watch the advertisements on TV without being offended, let alone afternoon soaps, which are surely soft porn, let alone the talk shows that introduce perversions into my mind that I haven't even imagined, okay, let alone MTV, which approaches being hardcore porn. I call this the frog in the water effect. Some of you might have heard this story that is useful. If you put a frog into boiling water, it will actually jump out. But if you put it in a pot of lukewarm water and gradually raise the temperature to boiling, it will quite happily boil to death, right, and not notice. And I think that's what's happened to us. In the 1960s, my father and every other father on the street, I think, would have taken the TV and smashed it on the pavement if MTV would have come into our homes. And now we're quite happily boiling to death with the TV that we have. Not to mention, of course, crime in the streets, not to mention drive-by shootings, not to mention gangs and all the things that we're all frightened about. You might say, how can you trace any of that to contraceptives? And I'll do it for you in a minute. But first I want to go through his predictions. Secondly, he predicted that there would be a general lowering of, or a general disregard for the physical and psychological well-being of females by males. Again, I think pornography is a great assault on a woman's psychological and physical well-being. There seems to be an enormous outbreak of sexual abuse of women. The statistics are just overwhelming for how many women have been sexually abused by someone in their household. Not to mention the fact that 60% of the poverty in the United States is accounted for by single women with children. Most of those living in poverty in the United States are single women with children. And that seems to me to be clearly psychological and physical abuse of women. And how did that happen? How do we get all these single mothers with children? I'll talk about that in a minute. The third prediction was that governments would use family planning programs for coercive purposes once contraception became widely available. And it's outrageous what's going on in this world. Some of you have been watching the deliberations of the UN, highly backed by the United States, to say that all economic aid to third world countries will now be tied to aggressive population programs. These countries must have aggressive distribution of contraceptives, sterilization, and ready access to abortion if we are going to feed and take care of the poor. I don't know if you've seen this in the news, but it's been in the Catholic press, that the women delegates to the UN are outraged at this. Right? They find this insulting and demeaning, like they're being treated like breed cows. What they want is better prenatal care. What they want is better medical care. What they want is more access to education and food for their children that's not tied to contraceptive programs. And some of you may know, be familiar with the work of Stephen Mosher, very well documented, that there are forced abortions in China. In many areas of China, if a woman has more than one pregnancy, more than one baby, the second pregnancy will be forcibly aborted. Women are actually dragged out of fields late in a pregnancy and forcibly aborted. Now, we've all lived through several weeks of seeing a national outrage because an adolescent is being caned in Singapore as a great violation of human rights. But do any of you hear or have you seen any sort of national outrage for what's going on in China? Pope Paul VI's fourth prediction was that would we begin to treat our bodies as though they were machines, right? Would no longer have respect for the human person as an integral unity of body and soul, but the body would now be a machine that we can do to whatever we will. Now, there's no greater evidence than that than our use of reproductive technologies, of surrogate motherhood, for instance. In many of these in vitro procedures. Some of you are caught onto the story around Christmas time of a 59-year-old woman in England who conceived a child through in vitro fertilization. Now, Irma Bombeck said this would never catch on. She said that 59-year-olds will leave a baby in a room and forget where they left it, or show up at a high school graduation and not know what they were doing there, or why they were there. But the point is that any woman can buy a baby. Any woman can go to an in vitro clinic and simply buy herself some semen and get herself impregnated and get the kind of baby she wants. It gives a new meaning to the word designer genes, right? If you want a Nobel laureate, you go to Stanford. If you want a hot whiz kid from MIT, you go to a clinic outside of MIT. If you want an East Coast Ivy League whiz kid, you go outside of Harvard. And you can buy yourself a baby. Married, unmarried, homosexual, heterosexual, any woman can do this who has the money. Tell me we're not treating our bodies like machines. What about the other predictions of the secular world who thought contraception would be so great? What about this prediction that marriages would be better? I think in some respects marriages are better. But the divorce rate shows us that there are a lot of very bad marriages, or at least marriages that end because people think they're very bad. In fact, the divorce rate doubled between 1965 and 1975. The divorce rate had been sort of sneaking up all century long until the mid-1960s. It was at 25%. And then in 1975, it got up to 75%, 50%. And so in a short 10-year period, the divorce rate doubled. And there's a demographer at the University of Stanford named Robert Michaels who was kind of intrigued by this. He wondered why it was that the divorce rate doubled in a 10-year period. And he actually discovered that as the contraceptive pill became more and more available, that line was parallel to the parallel of the divorce line. In about 1975, 1976, when every woman who wanted access to the pill had it, that's when the divorce rate leveled off. So in his statistical scientific investigations, he's discovered three reasons why he thinks the use of contraceptives have contributed to this massive increase of the divorce rate. He says he can attribute 45% of this increase to increased use of contraceptives. These are his reasons. There are three. I think there's others, and I'll also try to explain his. But his first reason is His first observation is that the statistical data shows that those who use contraceptives have fewer children and have them later in marriage. They have fewer children and have them later in marriage. And his statistical data shows that those who have the first baby in the first 2 years of marriage and another baby in the next couple years of marriage have a much longer lasting marriage than those who don't. Now, I'm sure everybody here in this room can tell me of someone they know who's been married for 25 years with 8 or 10 kids who's gotten divorced. And it's all very sad, but that's the rarity. It's the rarity. His data shows that those who have babies sooner in marriage have a longer lasting marriage than those who do not. And I'll give you about 3 seconds to figure out why. All right, he gives no explanation. I think there's several. One is that, again, some of you look like you've been around for a while. Some of you are actually pretty newly married. And it might become clear to you, for as blissful and as happy as those early years of marriage can be, they can also be very difficult. You've got two people with different habits and different expectations and different modes of communication trying to build a life together. And I've noticed with my friends who are newly married, at some point in that first year or two, it seems that one or the other gets in a car and goes for a drive and around the block and around the highways, and you don't really know if you're going to come back. Right? You're pretty darn mad about something. But if Junior's in the house, all right, there's somebody's smiles you don't want to miss in the morning, right? So you go back, right? And you work it out with the person you're mad at. There's two people in the house you love. One you're mad at, and the other's the smiles you can't think of missing. If you have another child, there's two people whose smiles you really want. One you're mad at. You may love like crazy, but you're mad. But you go back and you work it out. And that's very important in marriage, to work those things out early in the marriage. I think it's also the point that people who have children become better people, I want to say, almost instantaneously. Almost instantaneously, they become better. It's been my good fortune to have met several of my male friends as they've exited from the delivery room. And some of you may have experienced this and seen others. Such individuals are generally delirious, right? And they babble. And they say things like this. You know, it's incredible. It's the most miraculous, marvelous, mysterious thing I've ever been a part of in my whole life. It's the best day of my whole life. I just can't believe it. And somewhere along the line, they say a phrase. They say, everything's different now. Okay? They say, everything's different now. And that's absolutely true. Because yesterday, they could care less who the mayor was, you know, or who was the chief of the police force, or who was president of the school board, and whether the playgrounds were safe, or how they spent their money, or how many movies were rated PG, and what was on TV. But today they care, right? And today everything's different. And now they're going to be careful about all of these things. Because when you're single, who cares about these things? It doesn't affect you. When you don't have any children, it doesn't affect you. When you have a child you're sending out to the world, all of a sudden you become protective of this child, and you know that all these influences need to be attended to. You also become more patient, generous, and kind, and hardworking, right? Because this baby is very demanding. It takes a lot of your time and a lot of your effort. And to become a better person, and you're married to a better person, and that makes for a better marriage. That's his first reason. Those who contracept have fewer babies later in marriage, and their marriages are weaker. And it seems clear to me why that's the case. Secondly, he says, since contraceptives have arrived on the scene, there's much more adultery than there was before. I'll give you 2 seconds to figure that one out. People have been tempted for the history of mankind, right? And it's easy enough to think about wanting an affair, but wanting a child out of wedlock is another story. But if most every woman is contracepting, then most every woman is available in a certain sense. And there's no real reason to say no. And adultery is absolutely devastating to marriages. The third explanation is that women are financially more independent. They do have fewer children. They do go into the workplace. And again, when they have difficulties in the marriage, it's much more easy to say, take a walk, than it is to work it out, because they need their husband for one fewer reasons than they did before. Now, I think there's several other reasons why contraceptives are damaging to marriage. It's hard to get really clear statistics on this, but just recently in the USA Today, I read that one poll shows that 37% of high school students are sexually active. Another said 57%. I saw another that said that 87% of college students have been sexually active. I think most of you know there's very few people who are going into marriage as virgins anymore. they're hired to find. And I think all this sexual activity for marriage, before marriage, is not good for marriage. Most people have been lied to at some point. Most people have made promises and broken those promises, and had promises made to them, and those promises have been broken. And they're marrying someone who has lied and made promises and had promises broken. And they don't trust each other quite as much. They don't even trust themselves quite as much. I've said these things before. I've made these commitments before. Can I keep them? He said these things before. He's made these commitments before. Can he keep them? And I've seen lots of people actually just slide into marriage. This whole notion that by having sex before marriage, you could make a better choice of a spouse, I think is absolutely erroneous. It seems to me that the sexual passion can obscure things rather than clarify things. You get used to the sexual relationship, and it kind of makes you ignore whether this person is selfish or lazy or egotistical. Things that another 2 years from now might really bother you. Right now, because of the sexual relationship, you overlook these things. I had a friend who was had this boyfriend for whom there was an enormous sexual attraction between the two of them. And they did start to have a sexual relationship, but found out that it was making both of them quite miserable. But they couldn't really get away from each other. That relationship went on for about 5 or 6 years, even though they lived on opposite coasts, and they would telephone each other and have these very heated phone conversations. At one point I asked her, I said, are you going to marry this man? It's just going on forever. Been more or less not seeing anybody else because he's been in the picture for the last 5 or 6 years. And then she finally said, well, you know, I just couldn't see him being the parent to my children. I couldn't see it. I can't see that. He's crazy, right? We have very different values. I'm a committed Catholic. He hates Catholicism. And when she said this, she finally realized she had to break it off. But that sexual attraction and attachment for years had obscured this. Until she finally figured it out. And I've seen a number of people who lived together before marriage. And a matter of fact, cohabitation is one of the real clear signs that a marriage isn't going to work. I heard a statistic the other day, I'll have to check it out, but a priest told me that he did a workshop in his parish on cohabitation. And in his studies, he discovered that 75% of those who live together before marriage, not have sex together, but live together before marriage, get divorced within the first 3 years. And I've seen people who do this, you know, they're 25, 26, 27, 28 years old. They've been living together for 2 or 3 years, and everybody's bugging them, why don't you get married? So they ask each other, well, why don't we get married? You know, they figure out they're not fighting that much. And they certainly don't want to start all over again. I mean, this last 2 or 3 years was hard enough, and who wants to start all over again? And you might just as well get married. It seems to be time. And that's not the best path into marriage. So it hasn't made for better marriages. So, has it made for fewer unwanted pregnancies? The statistics on this are wild. In 1960, some 6% of white babies were born out of wedlock. 6%. In 1992, 22% of white babies were born out of wedlock. Almost a fourfold increase, and it's rapidly rising, rapidly rising. In 1960, some 22%, same figure, 22% of black babies were born out of wedlock. Anybody know the statistic now? The percentage? 68%. 68% of black babies are born out of wedlock. That took 30 years. I don't think it will take 30 years for the 22% of whites to go up to 68 if we follow down the same path we are currently following. Now, here's my connection. First of all, the world tells us that if we have more and better contraceptives, we can solve these problems. There will be fewer unwanted pregnancies. But the point was, in 1960, again, there was almost no contraceptives available, especially to teenagers. All right, you had to know some tacky gas station somewhere and have a few quarters, and that's about the best you could do. But any teenager now can get a contraceptive from their guidance counselor, in fact, from some welcome-to-school kit in some schools, right? I mean, we live in a culture in which condoms can be handed out in schools and Bibles can't. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about our society. So it seems to me there's clearly more and better contraceptives aren't going to help. Teenagers have incredible access to them. You know, but teenagers are just as good at using contraceptives as they are as making their beds and doing their homework and doing their chores. Have about the same degree of reliability. I used to help with set up a pregnancy help center actually in South Bend, and we'd talk with these young girls, and we'd ask them, did you use a contraceptive? And they say, no, I wanted to buy a Prince album this month and I had to use my money for that. Or, you know, I didn't like the side effects, so I stopped. Or we broke up and I thought we weren't going to see each other again, but he came around again. And they get pregnant, right? And they're surprised. And of course, we have 1.5 million abortions a year. And how did these happen? 50% of women who go to abortion clinics tell us that they're there because of contraceptive failure. 50%. 80% tell us that they are contraceptively experienced. They know about it and they've used it before. But again, for one reason or another, they've stopped. But the real point, in my mind, is that contraceptives have launched people on a lifestyle that makes for sex outside of marriage, makes for sex in which babies and bonding are not welcome likelihoods. Right? And when they happen, disaster strikes. People now say, well, they're having sex outside of marriage and they get pregnant. What do they say? They use this wonderful phrase, I got pregnant by accident. And I always kind of mystified by this phrase. And I say, well, tell me, how did that happen again? See, I'm kind of naive, you know, but I caught on to this some time ago. And I know you can't get pregnant by accident. You can get hit by a car by accident, you know, and fall off a cliff by accident, but you can't get pregnant by accident. It actually means that something's gone right with an act of sexual intercourse, not that something's gone wrong. But because people are using contraceptives, they get pregnant. Oh, they're surprised. My gosh, you got pregnant. We didn't have that in mind. That wasn't a part of this picture. So we have to do something about it. What do we have to do? We have to trot down to the abortion clinic. Now, I will give you the highest authority of our land, all right? The Supreme Court says so. All right, there's an article out there I wrote that's on the table you can have for free. It's called The Connection Between Contraception and Abortion. Now, I cite Planned Parenthood versus the state of Pennsylvania versus Casey. And in that decision, this is not quite verbatim, but it's close. It says, in several important respects, the decision to use contraception is the same as the decision to abort. Or the decision to have an abortion is the same as the decision to contracept. And it goes on to explain. It says, for 2 decades, couples have based their intimate relationships on the availability of abortion should contraceptives fail. For 2 decades, couples have based their intimate relationships on the availability of abortion should contraceptives fail. Now, in this whole Supreme Court decision, which is on abortion, there is not one mention of the humanity of the unborn child. Not one mention of whether the fetus is a person or not. It's not even dismissed as a question. It's not even considered. But it does say we must have abortions because we have contraceptives. It's a necessity. For 2 decades, couples have counted on it should their contraceptives fail. The Supreme Court says so. Okay. Now, again, I think in the 60s, it was not a stupid expectation that contraceptives would make for better marriages, fewer unwanted pregnancies, fewer abortions. But I think the cultural evidence today shows absolutely the contrary. And it's very hard for us to see because, again, our culture, our president, his cabinet tell us that more and better contraceptives and more and greater access to abortion is absolutely necessary in this society. It's a good thing. Now, the church said otherwise. I told you Pope Paul VI didn't predict this in great detail, but he certainly predicted the broad strokes of what happened. And you might say, how did he see it when the rest of us couldn't? All right? How did he see it? What did he know that we didn't know? Well, he had a whole history of the church behind him, some 2,000 years. And some of us, of course, believe he had the guidance of the Holy Spirit and he couldn't miss, right? Because he wasn't using human wisdom here. Human wisdom showed something quite different. And I don't think that human wisdom was implausible. But it turned out, I think, to be dead wrong. What did he know? Well, the church has always based its teaching, not on something private to Catholics, but on what is known as natural law. And then I'm going to give you about a three-minute course here in natural law. And natural law says that if you want things to prosper, you have to use them in accord with their nature, right? If you want things to prosper, you have to live in accord with the reality or the nature of the things that you're using. If you want to grow good tomatoes, you have to treat tomato plants in accord with their nature. You have to give them sunshine and water and fertilizer and a good soil. And if you want your car to run, you have to put oil and gasoline in it. You can't put your tomato plant in the closet and expect it to grow good tomatoes. You can't refuse to water it and expect it to grow good tomatoes. You can't put molasses in your car and expect it to run. And the church has said human sexuality has a certain nature. And unless you live in accord with that nature, chaos will result. You won't get your tomato plants and you won't get from here to Cleveland, right? It won't work if you don't live in accord with the nature. And the church says, and it says that this again is not revealed wisdom. This is something that man can discover by the basis of his own reason if he's not obscured by his culture, which we are. But if you strip away our cultural conditioning, I think you can see this. You say, what is the purpose and meaning and nature of sexual intercourse? Seems to me it's quite clear. It's for two things. It's for babies, and it's for bonding. And that's what happens when you have sexual intercourse. You have babies, and you bond. And my view is if you don't want to have babies and you don't want to bond, then you shouldn't be having sexual intercourse. And my view is that the babies and bonding that comes with sexual intercourse belong only within marriage. And I would love some rap group to put together a little song for me on it, you know? If you don't want babies and bondings, you shouldn't be having sex. You shouldn't be having sex if you're not married, because that's where babies and bonding is appropriate. Again, we have a whole culture that says having sex and having babies and making bonds are two different things. Absolutely two different things. Having sex, you say, I want to have lunch with you, I want to play tennis with you, I want to go to movies with you, and I want to have sex with you. No big deal, right? It's contraceptive that allows me to do this. Again, if I find myself pregnant, I'm shocked. If I find myself attached to you, I'm shocked. We all know all these really wonderful women who seem to be attached to these terrible men. Say, how does this happen? She can't let him go. She's engaging in sex with him. That's bonding. All right? So our society has this view that these two things are separate. And the church says, no, they're together. Now some people want to say, oh, no. You've left something out here. Clearly sex is for pleasure. And those who are having sex are doing what sex is for. They're having pleasure. I said, no, you've missed the point, okay? That there's lots of things that have pleasure attached to them. Pleasure is not the purpose. Pleasure is the motive, and pleasure is the consequence, but it's not the purpose. As a matter of fact, God attached pleasure to the things that he really wants us to do, that are necessary for our survival and for our happiness. So it's pleasurable to eat, and it's pleasurable to drink, and it's pleasurable to sleep, and it's pleasurable to exercise, and it's pleasurable to have sexual intercourse. Pleasurable. That's not the purpose. That's not the reason we eat, though some of us do. It's not the reason we sleep, though some of us do. But that's not the real purpose for these acts. They're restorative in many ways. Right? They're necessary for our survival. So God attached pleasure to everything he wanted us to do for our salvation, not our salvation so much as just our well-being. Right? But we have to do it at the right time, in the right place, in the right manner, with the right person, etc., etc. In the right way. Sure, eating is pleasurable, but there's limits to what you should be eating. Sexual intercourse is pleasurable, but there's limits to what you should be doing. And you have to seek that pleasure in accord with the nature and reality of what you're dealing with. Now, in many ways, the modern world is completely at odds with the church in viewing these things. Again, we live in a culture in which human life is considered of absolutely insignificant value. Otherwise, we would not be able to have abortion clinics. Right? My students, University of Dallas, are wonderful students. It's a good Catholic school. We get wonderful students. But they are as confused as the rest of the world about these things. They absorb as we all do. Every one of us absorbs the views of our culture. And my students, I was teaching one at Darwin one day, and I was making the point that human beings are radically different from animals. We may share common characteristics, but there's things that we can do that are so far out of the reach of animals that it can't even be compared. And afterwards, this one young girl came up to me and she said, Professor Smith, I don't see why you're so obsessed with the difference between human beings and animals. They're just not really all that different. And I said, all right, well, let me try to help you see this. So I did a kind of a far side thing for her. You know, I said, have you ever gone home and found your dog, you know, painting the ceiling of his doghouse like the Sistine Chapel? She said, no, I've never seen that. You know, have you ever caught your cat, you know, pounding out a Mozart sonata? She said, no, never seen that. I said, you know, you don't even catch pigs playing rugby, which is at least the minimal human activity. And she said, no, I've never seen that. And I said, well, now, think about it for a minute. I said, why do you think they don't do this? And she said, because they're just not interested. Otherwise, they would. I mean, surely I could do these things if I were interested. But anyway, she's with our society on this. This is what we think, that there's no big differences between human beings and animals. We have a whole animal rights movement now where save the baby whales. That human beings can be taken into an abortion clinic and terminated. Right? Now, it's on this point of the value of human life that you can see this huge difference between the Catholic Church and the rest of the world, or Christians in the rest of the world, or most religious traditions in the rest of the world. Right? Because we see every human life as a new soul, as a new soul that God has brought into this world that's meant to exist with God for an eternity. You see, we don't really see human life as our culture does. Our culture now thinks, you know, of course people can have babies, that's okay. We somehow have this primitive need to reproduce ourselves. So it's all right to have two. You know, you certainly, we can understand you wanting your boy and your girl. We understand that. But you have more than two, and everybody begins to look a little bit suspiciously at you. What are you doing? I mean, we now think of babies really as environmental hazards, right? As little threats to the rainforest. I mean, my friends have told me that they're pregnant with their third child, and the nurse receptionist will say, Mrs. So-and-so, your pregnancy test is positive. Do you plan to continue this pregnancy? Right? Do you plan to continue this pregnancy? Or Mrs. So-and-so, would you like to schedule a tubal this time? Because surely you and your husband aren't going to have more than three. Or here's a stack of pamphlets that you get when delivering your third on different contraceptives. Because obviously you and your husband don't know what you're doing. You need some help here. And those who have a third child or more will tell you that in elevators or in doctor's offices or in grocery stores, people will approach them and say the most astonishing things. Don't you and your husband know how to control yourselves? Lady, are these all yours? Or how many are you going to have? And they're just astonished that anybody would want more than two children. You're allowed to have three if your first two are girls or first two are boys, because obviously you want your boy and your girl. But more than three is just, it's out of sight in our society. But of course, the Christian view is not this. The Christian view is that the whole universe actually exists for us. It's our support system. We're supposed to be here. All right? God made the universe for human life. And he wants souls. He wants lots of them. Go forth and multiply and fill the face of the earth. Go forth and multiply and fill the face of the earth. Now, a little piece of evidence for this is that most women will tell you that their greatest sexual desires are when they're ovulating. Just like God giving them a shove in the back, right? Go for it. This is what we want here. Nature's way. God made nature. Right? Now, this is the most amazing thing when you think about it. This is amazing. You know, a sperm, this little sperm, it does not have an immortal soul. All right? This little sperm does not have an immortal soul. It has a short and sometimes very happy life, but it does not have an immortal soul. And the ovum, you see, it does not have an immortal soul. It can have a short and happy life, but it doesn't have an immortal soul. And when the two come together, where does that immortal soul come from? The sperm doesn't carry it. The egg doesn't carry it. Where does it come from? It comes from a new act of creation by God. In each act of conception, there needs to be a new act of creation by God. One of my priest friends says that when new human life is created, the whole universe is changed because something has come into existence which did not exist before and will exist forever. It's just like when God made the whole universe, he made something from nothing. And now he's made a new soul from nothing. It didn't exist. There's not a whole group of souls out there that are sort of waiting around for a landing place. God actually performs a new act of creation. So when male and female participate in the sexual act, they have opened up this arena which God has designed for bringing forth new human life. And when they contracept, they are slamming that door in God's face. They're saying, we want to enjoy this pleasurable act that you gave us, but we do not want to let you perform your creative act. Now, I'm not saying that couples who are contracepting are conscious that this is what they're doing, but this is what the act itself means. It's much like drinking a little bit of poison in your orange juice. You might not know it's there, but it will have its effect on you. Right? You're not intentionally doing that, but that's what the act itself means. So in the first place, the church objects to contraception because it refuses to let God perform his creative act in the arena in which he chose to do it. You know, God could have created new human life in different ways. In fact, he has before. I'm afraid I'm going to do a little male bashing here, but you're all used to it, so you can take it. You know, God did create new human life before in different ways. He made the first man, the first male, out of mud, right? And he made the first female out of the rib of a rational creature. Now, this explains a lot when you think about it, right? And one male, after one of my talks, came up to me and said, yes, certainly, it explains a lot. He said, it explains why I'm treated like dirt a lot. So anyway, our church, our society has a great disregard for the value of human life. We do not understand what a great gift it is to participate in this act with God. God has chosen spouses as his vehicle for bringing forth new human life, and new human life is precisely what he wants in this universe. As a matter of fact, every one of us should be putting forward most of our efforts, all of our efforts, to getting ourselves to heaven and helping others. That's our job, right? And spouses play a major role in this by bringing forth that new human life that all of us are meant to be forming. It's an amazing task that God has given us. It's not something to be dallied with. It's not something that should happen as an accident. Having sex, having babies as an accident is not in God's plan. Having babies is meant to be within a loving act of spouses because God wants the parents to love the children in the same way in which he loves all of us, which means in a committed and unconditional way. God loves us in a committed and unconditional way, and he wants parents that are committed to each other for a lifetime relationship who are going to love these children in an unconditional way. And our society can't begin to see that. Babies are just options, burdens, environmental hazards, something to be taken down to the abortion clinic and terminated. Now, along with our disregard for the value of human life is an enormous disregard for fertility. Right? We don't have any high estimation of fertility. Contraceptives are manifestly related to an hostility to fertility. Think about the word contraception. It means against the beginning of a new life. And what makes a new life possible is fertility. So we talk about the pill. It's one of my favorite words, the pill. And when do you take a pill? You take a pill when you're sick, right? But pregnancy is not a disease, and fertility is not a disease. Fertility is a healthy condition in an adult person. It's those who are infertile who need assistance in becoming fertile. They are the ones who need the medication. Fertility is a perfectly healthy condition. I don't like to challenge doctors in this way, and anyone who wants to straighten me out afterwards, you're welcome to have a shot at it. But when I think of a 15-year-old boy who goes in the doctor's office and says, doctor, you know, I want to get the girls. I want the girls. He says, and the way to get the girls is to have big muscles. So would you please give me some steroids? And any doctor worth his salt will say, son, get out of here. Join the wrestling team. Lift weights. Do push-ups. I'm not going to give you steroids. They're bad for you. They could ruin you. I'm not giving you steroids. But a 15-year-old girl trots into a doctor's office and says, doctor, I want to have sexual intercourse with my boyfriend or boyfriend. And the doctor says, I'll write you a prescription. And it's a whole lot worse for her health, psychologically and physically in the long run, to be launched on the kind of lifestyle that a contraceptive launches her on than that steroid is for the young man. And I want to know, what's going on here? Why has our culture told us that this makes sense? Why has our culture told us that this is a sensible thing for a doctor to do? Okay? Now, there's a wonderful book out by Dr. Ellen Grant called The Bitter Pill. And she was very much in on distributing contraceptives in the 60s in London. But she saw woman after woman coming in with different pathologies that she found were pill-related. High blood pressure, blood clots, cysts in the breast, all sorts of things, lumps in the breast. So she said, I'm not going to prescribe these anymore. She looked into this, and she discovered that when they were first testing for the pill, they were trying to find a male contraceptive pill and a female contraceptive pill. And in the first study group of males, they found that there was some slight shrinkage in the testicles of one male. Right? So they stopped all testing of the male contraceptive pill. You might notice that there is no such thing. Right? In the first study group of females, three females died. Right? And they just readjusted the dosage. Now, I don't know what that tells you, that tells me there's something sinister going on here. Right? Women are still dying from the pill. If you look at the insert in any set of pills, and you can get this from a pharmacist if you can't find it elsewhere, it says such things as the pill will cause blood clots, high blood pressure, heart disease, some greater increase of some kinds of cancer, infertility. Now, these are very small percentages where this happens, but there are some 16 million women in the United States on the pill, 16 million. And even a very small percentage is still a very large number of women. Not to mention the day-by-day side effects. These always fascinate me. Most women, in fact, 50% of women who start on the pill stop within the first year because of unpleasant side effects. So these side effects are really largely those of the 16 million who continue. So you can imagine how bad they must be for the 50% who stop. But what are they? Most women complain of increased irritability, okay, increased propensity to depression, weight gain, and a reduced libido. Now, I don't know about the rest of you women, but I've been looking for a pill that will make me more irritable, more depressed, help me gain weight, and reduce my libido so I can have sex. Right? And I'm sure all the men here would like the woman he's dealing with to be more irritable, more depressed, to gain weight more easily, and to have a reduced libido. Don't you? Now, why does the pill do this to a woman? Why does it do this to a woman? Well, the fact is that the pill makes a woman's body think it's pregnant. It gives its hormones that are there in the first couple months of pregnancy. And women in the first couple months of pregnancy get irritable, depressed, gain weight, and have a reduced libido. And women are in this condition when they're on the pill for week after week, month after month, year after year. It's an astonishing thing. Now, I haven't really told you the worst reality about the pill, which is really that it's an abortifacient. I've been talking about it as though it were a contraceptive. But it also works as an abortifacient, at least it says so, in the insert that's in the pill. It says in the insert that's in the pill that it works in three different ways. One is it stops ovulation. And again, that's clear enough. If it makes your body think it's pregnant, it will not ovulate because when you're pregnant, you can't get pregnant. When you're pregnant, you don't ovulate because you have a new baby growing inside of you and there's no reason to ovulate. Or, if that doesn't work, if there happens to be breakthrough ovulation and no woman knows when that's happening in her body. I mean, women have the most complex hormonal system. As you know, if you've ever looked at a chart of the female hormonal system, there's three major ones as far as their reproductive system is concerned. And they go up and down like peaks and valleys and they crisscross, right? And I showed this to one of my friends and she said, you know, I've never felt like the same person from day by day and now I see that I'm not. I'm dealing with a whole new chemical system every day. And as you women know, you wake up in the morning and you say, am I going to be the sweetest person in the world today or am I going to be the meanest person in the world today? How do I know? Let me see how I feel after my coffee. And it mostly has to do with your hormones. You know, male hormonal system, it's just wonderful. You know how much fluctuation there is in that? There's two of them. Straight line, all month long. Okay? This guy seems steady day by day, same guy yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And you don't know who you are yesterday, day, and tomorrow. There's explanations for that. It's called hormones. But a woman doesn't know month by month how her hormones are acting, whether she's not ovulating when she's on the pill, or if there's breakthrough ovulation. And the pill can, what it's called, change the viscosity of the mucus. Right? There's a certain mucus that helps the sperm get to the egg and a certain mucus that prohibits the sperm from getting to the egg. And it will change the mucus. Or it will prevent the nidification of the fertilized ovum. Right? That means fertilized ovum, new little human being, working down the fallopian tube, trying to implant itself in its mother's uterine wall, nest, nidate, right? But it prohibits that, and the woman sloughs off the new fertilized ovum. And a woman doesn't know how this is working in her system. Norplant works this way, the IUD works this way, Depo-Provera works this way. And think of the other forms of contraception, true contraceptives, the barrier methods. It's a wonderful word. I want to make love to you, but I've got to get my barrier in place. Sounds a bit like making war, not love, right? I got to get a good spermicide. Spermicide means kill the sperm. I want to make love to you, but I'm going to kill any sperm that come my way. Something hostile in that act. But I claim it's hostile primarily to a female's fertility. Because, you know, it's males who can have sex and not get pregnant. So what the pill does and contraceptives do is make a female like a creature that can have sex and not get pregnant. But that's not what we are. And it's not a great burden and a great defect to be a person who can have sex and get pregnant. That happens to be a great gift. But we treat it as though it were a great deficit, something that needs medication, devices, etc. So for now, I've given you two reasons why the church teaches that contraception is wrong. One is that it locks God out of his procreative act. The other is that it treats a natural gift of life and fertility as if these were not gifts, as if they were burdens and defects. Right? The third thing is John Paul II's observation. He claims that contraception violates not only the procreative meaning of the sexual act, but also the unitive meaning of the sexual act. It prevents not only babies, but it also prevents bondings. I'll give you another Adam and Eve joke just to lighten you up a bit here. And this is Adam and God in the garden. And they're having a little conversation. And Adam says to God, he says, God, he said, I'd like to thank you for this creature Eve you made for me. He said, she's just wonderful. He says, thank you a lot. And God says, you're welcome, Adam. Adam says, but God, I do have a complaint. God says, all right, Adam, what's your complaint? He says, well, he said, why'd you have to make her so beautiful? He said, you know, she's so beautiful that I think about her all the time. I get distracted. I can't get my work done. He said, you didn't have to make her so beautiful. Why'd you make her so beautiful? And God says, well, Adam, I not only wanted you to have a helpmate. He said, I wanted you to have someone to love, and you would be happy. Adam says, oh, wow, gee, hadn't thought of it. Thank you, God. That's very thoughtful. He says, but I do have another complaint. God says, all right, Adam, what's your second complaint? And Adam says, well, God, he said, why'd you have to make her so dumb? He said, you know, she's just so dumb, she doesn't make any sense, she's irrational, you talk to her, I don't know what she's up to, one day I'm the greatest guy in the universe, the next time I'm the worst guy in the universe. He said, why'd you have to make her so dumb? And God says, well, Adam, I not only wanted you to love her, I wanted her to love you. Sorry, guys. But, you know, it cuts both ways. That one cuts both ways, right? But isn't that the point? That God made male and female to love each other, to have babies, and to bond. And we have to think about how violating this procreative meaning of the sexual act is also violating the bonding meaning of the sexual act. First of all, in a simple way, John Paul II has very profound and beautiful things to say about this, and I can only give you the briefest of descriptions of this. But he says that the sexual act is meant to be an act of total self-giving. You want to give everything you've got to this person. And when you're withholding your fertility, you're withholding something that belongs in this action. It actually belongs there. And to withhold it means that you're not giving of yourself completely. I mean, I compare contraceptives to someone who says, you know, you're having a bad hair day. Would you mind putting a paper bag over your head? You know, I want to make love to you, but I can't stand looking at that hair. It's driving me crazy. And that's what a condom is, and that's what a contraceptive is. I love you, but I don't want a very important part of yourself here. Something that actually belongs in this act. Because think of the difference between these two phrases. I want to have sex with you, and I want to have a baby with you. Awesome, the difference. Again, our society says, I want to have lunch with you, I want to go to movies with you, I want to play tennis with you, I want to have sex with you. No big deal. But if someone comes up to you and says, I want to have a baby with you, you should be knocked off your feet. Because if they have any idea what they're saying, you know what they're saying. I want to be with you from now to forever. First of all, we'd be bringing forth a new immortal soul, and we have an immortal link through this immortal soul that wouldn't exist if we hadn't engaged in this act. It also means I like your eyes and your smile and the way you walk, and I want to bring another one of you into this world. Right? And I like the way you think, and I want my children to think like you. And I'm willing to be there for midnight feedings and breakfast and PTAs and weddings and the long haul. I don't want to have a baby with you. That's an incredible thing to say to someone. I want to have sex with you. We say that with the greatest of casualness. I want to have babies with you. If you know what you're saying, it's an incredible act. So you have this incredible bond with a person when all of your acts of sexual intercourse leave open the ordination to procreation, whether it's literal or symbolic. At least it's there and preserved in some sense. And that moves me to my last point. You've been patient, but I still have to say some more. And this is this. You all want to wait for this part. You're not ready to move yet. This is the differences between contraception and natural family planning. You know that a lot of people say, what's the difference? You have two couples who don't want to have a baby and want to have sex. And they're doing the same thing. They're trying to have sex without trying to have babies, without wanting to have babies. They're doing the same thing. And that's a very common confusion and a very common complaint. I'm going to try and help you think about it. The first thing I want to say to such couples, such people, is, well, if contraception and natural family planning are the same, why not just use natural family planning? and you know what they say. But that would be completely different. I'd have to change everything. But I said, wait a second, you just told me there's no difference. And now you tell me it would be completely different. But of course what they mean is that there's no moral difference, but they recognize there'd be an enormous lifestyle difference. I said, but wait a second, if there's an enormous lifestyle difference, then that may be a hint that there's some kind of moral difference as well. And first, I try to point out to them the simple principle in ethics that the ends do not justify the means. Stated another way, you must have good means to good ends. Not only your goal must be good, but also the way you get there must be good. So you have a couple who doesn't want a child for probably a very good reason. A couple who's contracepting. A couple who's natural family planning, they can also not want a child at this point for a very good reason. But one uses contraception and one uses natural family planning. Just like two men who both want, or individuals who want to support their family. One robs a bank and one gets a job. You want to say they're both doing the same thing, they're both supporting their family, but they've chosen very different means. And I try to indicate why I think contraception is wrong. It says no to God and His creative act. It says fertility is a bad condition as opposed to a wonderful condition. It puts a wedge between the giving between a husband and a wife. And it has dreadful consequences for society. I want to claim that natural family planning is not open to those same kinds of objections. It does not do those same things. Now, most couples who are frightened about using natural family planning, and frightened is the right word, they are frightened of using natural family planning. And largely for two reasons. One is they think it doesn't work. And I would like to show all of you an article from the British Medical Journal, September 18, 1993, where a doctor reviews the evidence on natural family planning and says it's more effective than the most effective contraceptive. More effective. He cites studies from, of all places, Calcutta. And you know who it is who's teaching natural family planning in Calcutta. This diminutive Catholic nun. All right? And he's found out that most of these are Muslims and Hindus to whom she teaches this. And they have what is called a virtual zero pregnancy rate, 0.004 pregnancy rate. All right? Look it up. But that doesn't seem to convince people. They're thinking of the old rhythm method, some 27% ineffective. And you have to tell them there's a huge difference between the rhythm method and the modern methods of natural family planning. I can give a review course on them in a minute, but I'm talking about the moral business here. The second is they're afraid of the abstinence. Right? They think the abstinence will just be too hard. And it's mostly the women who are afraid of it. And they're afraid of it because of the males. They think, my husband will get too irritable. He'll get too grumpy. He'll be removed and distant and won't be affectionate and will stay away from me during that time. And how will we make up our fights? And how will we talk? And I'm nervous about what's going to happen. And men feel greatly deprived. Who can go that long? Who can go 7 to 12 days? It's not right. Right? That's not what I got married for. Right? But my observation is this, that those who have used contraception before marriage and used contraception within marriage, they are very frightened of the abstinence because sex has become key to their relationship. And they think that when you take the sex out of the relationship, where's the love going to be? Where's the intimacy going to be? But couples who have abstained before marriage have little or no problem with natural family planning. Little or no problem. And that's for a very good reason, because they think that abstinence is a way of expressing love. It's not this huge deprivation. Because the reason that they abstained before marriage was not because they weren't attracted to each other, not because they didn't have abundant opportunity, not because they weren't madly in love with each other and the hormones were raging, but because they loved each other. And they said, I'm not going to have sex with you before marriage because I love you. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to have a stronger commitment than I've made here. I don't want to put us in danger of having a baby when we haven't really prepared for that baby. Marriage is preparation for those bonds. Marriage is preparation for that baby. Right? And I love you. And I can wait. That's how much I love you. Within marriage, abstinence has that same aspect. It's not a good idea for us to have a child right now. We can abstain. We did it before. We know how to show our affection at this time. We know how to be loving to each other at this time because we've done it before. And they can do it. Women who use natural family planning have an amazing sense of self-respect and well-being. Right? They think that their fertility is revered by their husbands, and they think they've got themselves particularly good husbands. I've got my husband who's particularly good. He's a wonderful man. He's got high moral standards. He doesn't treat me like a sex object. I can trust him. right? He likes me even when we're not having sex together. He's a great guy. I got myself a good one. And males have a great reverence for their wives. This fertility, they don't want to damage her body. They don't want her to take all these pills and use these devices. And they say, no, I love her. I wouldn't put her through those risks. Right? I can. And this woman's willingness to have a baby for me, that's a wonderful thing. What a woman puts herself through. And I am going to respect that. Right? So there's this deep bond between the two of them. And it doesn't say no to God. You see, it respects a woman's fertility. Has no bad social consequences, in fact, wonderful ones. There's almost a non-existent divorce rate among couples using natural family planning. It doesn't say no to God, because God has said, I want to be there at the fertile time. I made the fertile time for bringing forth new human life. If you engage in this act, I want my option of making new human life. But I gave you a half of a month, three quarters of a month, where you're infertile. You want to pursue the bonding power of sexual act without babies? Do it then. I'm asleep. I'm out of town. Okay? I don't expect to be invited at that time. I'm not around. You can't even do it. Okay? I won't come. I can't. I made your body in a certain way. There's no saying no to God. There's respecting the fertility as if it's kind of sacred ground. You don't walk there unless you're prepared for the consequences. It's much like dieting. People tell you natural family planning is much like dieting. We have this phenomenon now of bulimia. People eat and they throw up. That's a bit like contraception. You want the pleasure, but you don't want the consequences. You engage in the act and you violate the act. Whereas natural family planning is a lot like dieting, but a lot better. When you diet, you can't eat the chocolate cake, you have carrots and celery. Sex during infertile time apparently is a lot better than carrots and celery. Your options are better. There's a pinch in it. It's difficult, but it's not impossible, and it does great things for marriage. Couples will tell you, they've always told me this, you read this in all the NFP literature, those who use natural family planning communicate better with each other. I've always wondered what that meant. Does it mean people are even having sex or talking, but not both? And because they're not having sex during the fertile time, does that mean they're talking more? But there's something to that. You know, I've read somewhere that couples, I'm not married, and of course I'm envious in many respects of the married, especially for companionship, but you read things like people say that there's 27 minutes a week on the average that couples talk to each other. I say, gosh, if that's all it is, maybe it's not worth it. 27 minutes. But anyway, these natural family planning couples must use that 27 minutes well. And they tell me the conversation, I figure this out, what they're talking about. It goes something like this. They have this conversation once a month, maybe 12 times a year. And it happens on that weekend when the mother-in-law takes the children, or you have a nice little business trip, and you're looking forward to this nice weekend together. Little quiet lunch, maybe some shopping, a movie, a romantic dinner. And then a nice evening of relaxed lovemaking with no children, no stress, just a nice night. And the woman gets up in the morning and she says, darling, I'm afraid I've entered the fertile phase. Right? So there's this deflation, this disappointment. The weekend's not going to be everything we thought it would be. This little conversation ensues, which usually starts with the question, why are we doing this? Right? Why are we abstaining? And sometimes that provokes a conversation about contraception and why or why not, but usually that's settled. And usually the question means, why did we decide it's not a good idea to have a baby? Why are we abstaining? And the husband might say, well, you know, the reason we decided not to have a baby right now is you said you're too tired. You've got too many little ones, or you've got a job now, and you're really fatigued, and you really can't imagine having another child. Are you still tired? Right? And she might say, well, no, as a matter of fact, I'm not too tired right now. The younger one's a little bit older, and, you know, I think I might be able to handle another baby. Let's take a risk. Let's really enjoy this day in the way we planned. Or she might say, of course I'm still tired. You never help. Okay, you said you'd give the kids a bath. You don't give them a bath. You said you'd let me have Saturday afternoons free. I've never had a Saturday afternoon free. Of course I'm still tired. And he might say, I'll start bathing them tomorrow, dear. Right? Or he might say, she might say, the reason we're not having a child right now is you said that your financial burdens are too great. You can't imagine supporting the family we already have, let alone any more. Are you still financially burdened? And he might say, well, no, I'm not. We refinanced the house, and I was kind of panicking. I'm getting a promotion. Things are okay. Let's take a risk. Or he might say, of course I'm still financially burdened. Your friend Jane gets a fence around the house. You have to have a fence around the house. Your friend Jane gets a new kitchen. You need a new kitchen. Your friend Jane gets new dishes. You need new dishes, right? And she might say, I don't need those new dishes. But the important thing is that they're having this conversation, and it's a conversation that's focused around the most important things, which is why they're having babies and why they are not having babies. and how their life is going together, and are they sharing the burdens or not. And couples use contraception tell me that they can go for a very long time without having that conversation. They can say, we're not going to have babies for another 3 to 5 years, and we'll talk about it then, and that's when they talk about it. And they go apart and move to their jobs and come back for dinner and go to jobs and come back for dinner, and that's about what it is. So I'm saying natural family planning does not have bad social consequences. It's very difficult to use outside of marriage. It does not say no to God and his procreative act. It treasures a woman's fertility, and it enhances, not alienates, the relationship between spouses. It is not subject to the same objections as contraception. Now I'll close with one thing here and give you a chance to ask some questions. But I've taken to giving talks on premarital sex to my students with some frequency, and I've discovered that they are absolutely terrified at the notion of divorce. They hate divorce, right? Because they've either been children of divorced households and have experienced pain and trauma themselves, or they've seen their friends go through it, and they don't want it. When they want to get, they get married, they want to be married for good, and they're not all convinced it can be, because they've seen so much divorce around them. I have a brother-in-law who is the son of a divorced household. He was very young, and his father left the family. And my parents have been married now for coming up on 50 years. And he follows my father around. Like, my father has this huge curiosity. You know? Like, where did this man come from that could be married to the same woman for 50 years? And how did he do it? He can see how happy we all are with this wonderful, intact household, as we now call them. So I make my friends, my students, this offer. And either someday I'm going to be a very poor woman, or I'm going to be hailed as a prophet in my own time. Right? I make them this offer. I say, I will give them $1,000 if they get divorced, if they followed the formula that I tell them. And I really like to tell people what to do, and this is what I tell them to do. I say, first of all, I'm glad you've heard my talk. That's not necessary, but it helps. I say, but these are the four things you need to do if you want to get married and never get divorced. First of all, you can't have sex before marriage. Right? And I say, if you've started, stop. And stop for at least 1.5 to 2 years before you get married and start thinking about sex and what it's all about and why it's a good idea not to have sex before you get married. Secondly, when you get married in a church and go to church every Sunday and pray while you're there, you know. Go to church, get married in church, go to church. Thirdly, use natural family planning and not contracept within marriage. And fourthly, tithe. Give 10% of your money to church or charity. I said, if you get God, sex, and money in the right place, everything else is easy. Right? So I promised them this. So I've gone on and on and on, as I promised. I'm only through about the second step in the 12-step program in our non-stop talkers support group. But I would like to say, again, our culture thinks that contraception is one of the greatest things going. Again, I think it's very hard to escape that perspective in the culture in which we live. But when one sees the deeper reality that the church sees, you can begin to see why the church has an explanation for the chaos that has resulted as a result of a contraceptive society, and the rest of the world can't even see the chaos, let alone know what the causal connections are. So I thank you very much, and I'd like to take any questions you might have. Thank you for being so patient.
How is your message received by Catholic clergy?
The Catholic clergy? Oh, man, how am I received by the Catholic clergy? It's kind of a sad question. They're my hardest group to talk to. I've received maybe 6 to 10 invitations to address Catholic clergy and deacons. And this is at the mandate of their bishop. Now, even in these meetings, a lot of the ones who are really opposed to me don't show up. So I'm already starting out with a fairly sympathetic audience. Again, the statistics on this are hard to come by, and they're variant, but some studies show that only 35% of Catholic priests support the Church's teaching on this. I've seen as high as 47%. I expect it's as low as 35% or lower. I could be cynical. I think there's reasons for that. Again, reasons why they might not be as culpable as we might judge them to be. Before 1968... Again, in 1960, as I said, 66% of Catholics were living by the Church's teaching. Priests who were trained before Humanae Vitae were not trained to defend the Church's teaching or explain it. They were simply taught to assert it, and Catholics, for the most part, accepted it. After 1968, very quickly, dissenters got control over most of the seminaries, and most priests taught after 1968 were taught that the Church was going to change its teaching on this someday, and that Catholics, in good conscience, could dissent from the Church if their conscience told them this was all right. That's a whole other question. I mean, how many Catholics have really consulted their conscience on this issue? But let's leave it at that. So I'm speaking to an audience that has been largely for 25 years been actually doing what they were told, telling people that contraception is all right if their consciences tell them so. And I can kind of feel a real hesitancy when I start out, to say the least. In fact, usually the priests who support the church's teaching, I can identify them quite quickly. They're marginalized, and they actually sit on the margin. Okay, I can find them. I often find that about 20 minutes into my talk, I sense this real drop of certain defenses. And this could be entirely subjective on my part, but it's what I experience. And a sort of sense like, all right, there's something here. I better listen to this. And about another 45 minutes into the talk, I get the sense like, whoa, she's really starting to make sense. Maybe I better be nicer to those couples who use natural family planning and give them more support. And that's about as far as I think I get sometimes. I'm confident, much more confident about the upcoming clergy, those under 40 years of age. I found that they are much more likely to be supportive of the church's teaching on this topic, partly because they have seen the consequences of a contraceptive culture. Many of these young men have stood on the picket lines protesting abortion. And you don't have to stand on that line for long to make the connection between contraception and abortion, and then other things start to unfold from that. And a lot of them are much more inclined to think that this Pope has some wisdom and are ready to line up behind him. And he has really made this a major part of his pontificate. So I think there's hope in both respects. I think the older priests, I mean, priests have become priests because they want to lay down their lives and serve others. They're good souls. And they're permitting contraception is not because they want to lead people down the garden path, because they're actually doing what they've been taught for the most part. And I think that I think it's up to the laity to go a long way in helping them see what contraceptives have done to marriages. Thank you for the question.
Is there an impact of the loss of grace for couples who contracept?
I think that's about the impact of the loss of grace in the
That's a very good question. This question is about, is there an impact of a loss of grace on marriages? And I think, obviously, that 50% of marriages are ending in divorce among Catholics as well as the rest of the population suggests that there's an impact of a loss of grace in this. I think that those who contracept, even if they're confident that what they're doing is right, they can't feel quite as enthusiastic about their church as otherwise. They can't be quite racing to be full-fledged members of this church. Many of them are very active in their parishes and love their church, but they've got this sort of, my church teaches something that's wrong. And you can't have that full embrace. You're not confessing this because you don't think it's wrong. You're not getting the healing graces and the empowering graces from confession that you would get. I think couples who use natural family will tell you, natural family planning will tell you that prayer and the sacraments are at the heart of what they do. They need that help to be faithful to what they believe and to raise the children that they have. And so I think there certainly isn't, it's always hard to measure the impact of grace. I mean, that's an unseen reality. It's there, but to measure it. But I think it can be seen as far as what is happening with marriages. Again, I think if you're around couples who use natural family planning, you really do sense a quite spectacular closeness that they have, and self-respect and mutual admiration that I think is not as often clearly there in couples who contracept. And again, I think most contraceptors are what I would call subjectively innocent. They're doing something that is objectively wrong, but they're not getting up in the morning and saying, I want to perform an offense against God, I want to be hostile to my fertility, and I don't want to give myself to my spouse completely. They're not saying that, but again, their act says that. And I think they are going to be suffering harmful consequences from what they do and kind of be surprised at this. Let me just give you this little anecdote. I have a friend who has 7 brothers and sisters. They were all raised Catholic, and very few of them are practicing Catholics now. And all of them are contraceptors, except one couple. And the couple that is not contracepting, using natural family planning, have 4 children, all planned, etc. The other couples, again, have no children, all contracepting. 2 income households, you know, lots of disposable income, lots of time for romance and fun. And one night, the 8 of them were having a very open discussion about their sex lives. And all of the women, the contracepting women, were complaining that they felt that they were just being used in the sexual act, right? they felt that this was just one more thing that was expected of them, and they felt used. And the men were complaining. They were complaining that they had been reduced to begging for sex, which they found demeaning, and that they were engaging in sex with a woman who just wasn't all that engaged. She might just as well be watching TV. And they're having this conversation. A couple using natural family planning were kind of looking at each other quizzically and saying, what are they talking about, right? Sex not interesting? Sex not as interesting as TV? Begging for sex? I don't know what this is all about, right? They're doing just fine. Now, if you were to look at these couples, I mean, the contraceptive couples, two incomes, fitness clubs, you know, designer clothes, the couples with their four children, getting pudgy, gray, financially stressed, not as much sleep, etc. See, now, which couples are having a satisfying sex life? Right? It's amazing, but it's the opposite of what one would expect. And I think there's something there, again, in natural family planning that causes this kind of closeness and love between a couple that is really the heart and soul of really what makes sex good. It's not having a designer body and designer clothes and lots of disposable income. That won't buy you a good sex life. It's really trust and love and tenderness and really knowing and communicating with the individual with whom you are having sex. And that's what natural family planning brings about. And so if couples, I mean, these contraceptive couples, they might to suggest to them that contraception is the problem. It would be astonishing for them to think that that might be the problem. But it seems to me, again, there's good reason to think that maybe, in fact, that is what is making things flat in their relationship.
Do you think there should be sex education classes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the abstinence message is largely... Again, just refrain, largely because of either unpleasant consequences of some sexually transmitted diseases, which, of course, should not be underestimated. I mean, you certainly have the death-dealing AIDS, but you have, I think there's some 35 other strains now of sexually transmitted diseases, which are extremely damaging. I mean, there's apparently this huge increase in the amount of infertility, which is most traceable to these sexually transmitted diseases. Because women are having sex with more than one partner, getting these diseases, having scarring in their fallopian tube, etc. All these things, young people should know. They definitely should know all these things. But your notion is that chastity is something different from abstinence. And chastity really is understanding what your sexual powers are for. And in a certain sense, ordering your life in such a way that those sexual powers will be reserved to the time when it's appropriate. And this is something, again, that natural family planning, I think, really helps with. I mean, as you've all noticed, our society is absolutely saturated in sexual stimuli, absolutely saturated. That it's hard to, you know, go about an hour in the morning without having something assault your senses. You drive to work and you see three billboards with scantily clad individuals. You turn on TV, you see people embraced in some sexual act. I went to Dillard's, which is a department store, the other day to buy a coffee pot. You know, in every single aisle there was a perfume ad with a naked man and woman in this passionate embrace. And I'm thinking, I want to buy a coffee pot, okay? I did not want to see pornography, and here it is, I'm assaulted by this. This is not something, God did not hang these things from trees. You know, this isn't part of his design that we are going to have this kind of assault on our senses. I know friends who get up on Sunday morning and take the lingerie ads out of the newspaper because it's just as bad as Playboy. There's no point in having their 15-year-old boys be assaulted with this. But you can't avoid it. Music, etc. And what happens, and this happens more often to the male individual, though it can also happen to the female individual, but I'll do more male bashing. And make it the male. And he's been at office all day long. And this is not his fault. I mean, he's been assaulted by this when he drives to work. He turns on the TV. People tell dirty jokes. There's scantily clad women in the office place. His imagination starts to run. And all day long, he's fantasizing about some woman. He comes home at night and he's really ready to go. And there's a female in the kitchen, you see, who's quietly available. And now he has sex with this woman. He doesn't make love to this woman. He has sex with this woman. He's fantasizing about some other woman. Hasn't thought about his wife all day long. And natural family planning puts a kind of a stop to that. Because you see, you're going to have to abstain from 7 to 12 days a month. And you can't come home like that. So you've got to start shutting these things out. You've got to say, I don't want to listen to that, I don't want to see this, I don't want to look at this magazine, I don't want to watch this movie, because it fills me with thoughts that I'm not going to be able to act upon, and they're not fair to my wife anyway. I've started to appreciate this complex woman that I'm dealing with. And when I make love, I want to make love to her. And John Paul II says that natural family planning brings about what he calls the virtue of self-mastery, which is the same as the virtue of chastity. And he says it actually makes people better lovers. because now they're making love to the person they love rather than to some fantasy. And instead of satisfying some sexual urge, they can control those sexual urges, and now they're acting again upon a love impulse and not a sex impulse. And I think that's what young people have to learn, is that they are virtually assaulted by their culture. Not to mention, I think young people need to learn about original sin, and that all of us have disordered appetites in almost every angle of our life. We want to eat more, sleep more, drink more, and have more sex than is good for us, in ways with people, etc., that aren't good. And that's a result of our fallen nature. We can expect this, so we shouldn't sort of be startled and astonished and upset that these things are happening to us. It's part of the course of things. But we have to learn to reorder ourselves. And I think young people need to say, yes, this is going to happen to you. A lot of it's not your fault. It's the fault of your culture. The other problem is you're a human being. But you have to work at this, and the rewards are great. Again, the couples I've known who have gotten married and have been chased before marriage have this kind of innocence and euphoria in marriage, which is absolutely enviable. You know, this notion, this real trusting of each other, and this real sense that sex is clean and not dirty. That's one thing that happens with premarital sex, is people often get to think of sex as being something dirty. It's something naughty. It's something you sneak around and do. Whereas couples who wait until they get married, for them, sex is good. It's clean. It's pure. It's something I saved for this person. So all of that young people don't know what they're missing out on, when they're letting culture just sweep them along. I mean, I think the young people have just not been led by adults. They've been led by adults down the garden path. And we need to, you know, we've gone down some of those garden paths, some of those dead ends, and we need to warn them. It's not any good. We tried that. Don't you try it. You'll see. And I think that's, chastity is very different from the simple abstinence message. And again, our culture doesn't know how to teach abstinence, because every single moment of the day it works against abstinence. I mean, Chess. Wow, those seats are probably getting pretty hard. Whoops. You're the most hated man in the house right now. Go ahead.
How can we evangelize friends and family with this information?
Well, I think I'm going to count on you to do that. You sound like you're very capable of doing that. It's very hard to evangelize, especially one's own friends and family. But a good way of doing it is to start giving them tapes and the document. Listen to this, read this, instead of talking yourself. And say, after you've read this and listened to this, let's talk. I think that's the first step. It's just opening up a line of communication with a lot of people about this. Because, as I said, very few people have reflected on this, and understandably so, because nothing provokes them to reflect upon it. Few Catholics have ever read any encyclical, let alone Humanae Vitae. We are the most literate society in the history of mankind. But we read Newsweek and Consumers Report and People Magazine, and never a church encyclical. Well, this is a good one to start with. And Familiaris Consortio is great. They're all great. Once you get started, you start to learn how to wade through them. And they're wonderful. So I would start with that. Study groups. You have friends, and especially young people. Let's meet once every other week and go through Familiaris Consortio together. Get together and read it page by page. Don't make people read it ahead of time. Get together, read two pages, and talk about it. Married couples do the same thing. Invite some of your friends in and say, let's read this together. And you'll be amazed at what emerges from sessions like that. That's only one small suggestion, but I'm sure seminarians like you are going to make a difference for us. Thank you all very much.